Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. On the program today, the economic week that was, of course. We'll do some bank earnings too, and it's all going to be solar powered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Friday today. This one is the 13th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has obviously been a very big news week in areas not business and economic, and we are mindful of that. But there are 5 days worth of happenings in this economy to discuss, so we will. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Amara Omokwe is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Amara, let me start with you. We got some inflation readings this week, consumer prices, producer prices. They were, you know, steady-ish. In fact, Kristen Schwab did a story for us the other day about the Groundhog Dayification of inflation news. It all seems to be running together and generally the same. And so here's my question. Does it feel to you like we are stuck here with inflation where it is right now, despite the Fed's best efforts?
It feels like we're a little stuck. It feels like, you know, the report, the consumer price index report that came out yesterday, the response was basically like, not a bad report, but right. Not as good as you would have hoped, right? And you saw a lot of economists using words like choppy and bumpy, basically sort of reinforcing this idea that, yes, the Fed has made a lot of progress in bringing inflation down from where we were last year, but, you know, it's not necessarily going to be smooth sailing to get to target.
Target again being 2%, and we're you know, somewhere above that. Gina, let me ask you this. Neel Kashkari, the president of the Minneapolis Fed, said this week, words to the effect of, you know what? Maybe the bond market is going to start doing some of the heavy lifting for the Fed, and the Fed won't have to raise again. Could you, number one, explain what he meant? And then, number two, why do you think he said that?
Yes, we've seen a number of Fed officials come out and say, you know, we've really seen this recent run-up in longer-term interest rates in markets. So the Fed raises short-term interest rates, but those take a while to trickle out. We've only recently seen this big pop in the 10-year yield, which is very important to all kinds of debt, from mortgages to car loans. And so Fed officials like Kashkari are taking a look at that and saying, hey, maybe that big pop that just happened in markets is actually going to come along and sort of wallop the economy and slow it down quite a bit. And so that might mean that we have to do less, all else equal, to cool off the economy. Now, I think an important thing to note is that Kashkari wasn't really ready to sort of declare that to be the case yet. It's clearly something he's watching, but not something he's ready to commit to yet, because markets can give it and they can take it away, right? Markets move. So the move has been pretty significant, but we can't be sure that it's going to be sustained. So I think it's something they're watching. I don't think it's something they're ready to make decisions based on just yet.
Let me ask you this, though, Gina. Isn't it better? I don't know how to ask this without making the Fed look bad, but isn't it better to have the Fed in charge of the economy than the bond market in charge of the economy? Because as we've seen the last 10 days, the yields on the 10-year have been all over the place, and that implies a certain lack of control.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting here is that this is just sort of how Fed policy works. You know, they set the short-term interest rates. They do have a policy tool that they can use to sort of guide where longer-term interest rates are. That's their quantitative easing purchases. Mm-hmm. But that's not what they're using at this stage. You know, they're not primarily using that as an active tool of monetary policy. You know, there is a world in which they could just try and somehow influence those longer-term rates. They're not choosing to do that. And so in the world that we actually exist in, they are to some degree at the mercy of the bond market. Yeah. And so I think, you know, maybe not ideal, but just reality at this stage.
Amara, talk to me for a second about this world that we actually live in. If you are, as you are, as we all are, a consumer in this economy, and you look at things like consumer confidence, you and your fellow consumers are getting less and less feel good about this economy. Prices are still elevated, even though the rate of inflation is coming down. What do you make of it? I mean, are you giving up the ghost and saying, I'm going to hang on to my money and put it under the mattress?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are starting to feel a little bit more anxiety. Like when I talk to people who are trying to navigate this economy and you know, what should they buy? How should they live? You know, they are starting to feel a little bit more anxious. And I think that's in part because people have really had to deal with these higher prices for such mm-hmm. a long time now. Mm-hmm. And even though they hear politicians, they hear economists talking about the fact that inflation has cooled, but when they look at their lives and they look at the things that they want to buy, they're like, look, these prices are much higher than recent memory. And so I think that makes people feel a little hesitant about the outlook.
Gina, who actually, so we talked about the Fed being in charge a minute ago. Let me ask you this, though. With all the disarray amongst Republicans in the House, and it continues today, what effect does that have on this economy, do you suppose, and consumer confidence, right? You look at Congress, and Congress Republicans in the House are a mess. What kind of confidence do you have there?
Yeah, you know, I think it is really interesting. It's kind of early days to see how this is going to hit consumer confidence, but you could see a world where it does really affect consumers. There have been times in the past where consumers reacted really strongly to dysfunction in the government. I think around the ratings downgrade mm-hmm. that happened with the really bad debt ceiling standoff is one example of that. And so you could see a world where consumers react to this. And that would really pile on, actually, because consumers are already starting to feel a little bit worse. You know, in the recent readings of the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, which is one that I think we all follow pretty closely, you've seen consumers feeling a little bit less optimistic because they're feeling a little bit worse about inflation, actually. They've kind of marked mm-hmm. up their inflation expectations a bit. And so I think if we got political dysfunction adding to all of that uncertainty that people already feel about the inflation and what we were just talking about, I think that could be a pretty potent mix.
Amara, I'm obliged to note here that we have to do government funding in something just over 30 days. I've honestly lost count. And that is a not small thing.
That's not a small thing. There's a lot of gridlock on picking this next speaker. And we talked about the run-up in long-term rates. Mm-hmm. You know, some economists think that part of that is because of the worsening outlook on the fiscal situation, right? And so having this gridlock in Congress definitely does not help matters at all.
Yeah. Gina, can we go global here for a second? And I do want to talk briefly about the Middle East. And I want to talk about what Secretary Yellen said a number of days ago in Marrakesh. She, in almost this many words, said, I don't see the current conflict as bad and as terrible as it is as a macroeconomic issue for the global outlook. What do you think of that?
I think it's probably true in the moment right mm-hmm. now. That seems basically right. I think there's a big risk here, though. And Victoria Guida actually had a great story about this in Politico today, which is that you could really see this spilling over into oil and gas markets. You could see it. I mean, anytime there's conflict in the Middle East and anytime that Iran in particular is implicated, there's a risk that you get spillover into global energy markets. And that would be really painful at this moment. You know, we've finally seen gas prices at the pump coming down again, that people are feeling better because of that. And so if you saw a big run up in gas again, it would make it a lot harder for the Fed to sort of A, convince people that inflation is going to stay down on a sustainable basis, B, get inflation down on a sustainable basis, because even though they ignore gas on a day-to-day basis, it feeds into all kinds of other things like right. housing costs because of heating fuel and also things like airfares. And so, you know, could be bad if that were to come to pass.
Right. If it spreads. Gina Smilek at the New York Times, Amara Mokwe at the Wall Street Journal on this Friday afternoon at the end of a long week. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, tech stocks were down. Oil prices, as Gina was just talking about, crude oil, Brent North Sea, up 5.7% today. They were up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You remember all the regional bank agita this spring? Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank collapsing in March, then First Republic going under in the beginning of May? Things in that particular slice of the financial system have largely calmed down, but as often happens, when banks just a little bit lower on the food chain run into trouble, the big banks get bigger. and richer. The big Wall Street banks reported profits this morning. JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup told investors they netted a combined $22 billion these past 3 months. Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
The classic way banks make money, like the way they teach it in Banking 101, rests on three words: net interest income.
What the bank is receiving in interest, and you subtract the interest going out.
Myra Rodriguez-Valladares is managing partner at MRV Associates. Banks charge higher interest rates on mortgages or commercial loans or credit cards than the interest they pay you on your checking and savings accounts. And when the Fed hikes rates from near zero to 5% in a little over a year, that net interest margin actually gets bigger.
Any of the new loans that they've been originating in the last 2 years, they get to charge more and more. And yet there is a lag in how much and when the banks pay a higher rate.
That lag is the biggest reason behind national banks' profits this past quarter. The big banks know you're probably not going to leave them, even if you could get a slightly higher APY elsewhere. And even if you do, they have tons of other depositors and income streams. Smaller regional banks, though, not so much, says Xander Yoakum at CFRA Research.
So when they lose deposits, it can actually stop their ability to fund loans. So because of that, they really don't want to lose deposits, and therefore they pay a higher rate.
Yoakum says the fear-based flight out of regionals into national banks has subsided. But if you're a bank that's not too big to fail, you might be too small to be very profitable right now.
Regional banks are definitely struggling. Concern, obviously, in the office space and commercial real estate arenas.
Regional banks often specialize in commercial real estate lending, and demand for office space is still pretty weak. But while regionals will eat those losses most directly, Kairong Xiao at Columbia Business School says the big banks may not be immune.
Some of those loans are going to be packaged in the commercial real estate-backed mortgage-backed securities.
And Xiao says those commercial real estate mortgage-backed securities may be on some big banks' balance sheets, waiting to be marked down. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
You know what's waiting for you? If you miss something on the air, our podcast. You can subscribe or follow on the platform of your choice. You want to make progress in the climate crisis, which we all, you know, do. There is no one solution. Decarbonizing this economy is going to mean trying a lot of different things. Among them, today, the Biden administration announcing $7 billion from the infrastructure law for seven different hubs in 16 states to, as the White House puts it, accelerate the domestic market for low-cost clean hydrogen. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports on the clean energy transition from the top left corner of the periodic table.
Altogether, the Biden administration says the seven hydrogen hubs will catalyze another $40 billion in private investment and eliminate 25 million metric tons of CO2 emissions each year, mostly in what Beth Trask at the Environmental Defense Fund calls hard to decarbonize sectors of the economy.
That includes heavy industry, like powering steel factories and producing the alternative fuels we'll need for long-distance transportation. But we really have to get hydrogen right.
To that end, the hubs will use different strategies to make and use hydrogen. Alex Kaiser is with the Energy Futures Initiative Foundation.
The opportunity is when hydrogen is used, there are no greenhouse gas emissions released. And the challenge is how to produce hydrogen in low carbon ways.
And that challenge is a big one, says Sean O'Leary. He's a senior researcher at the Ohio River Valley Institute.
The hydrogen hub that's being announced for our region, the ARCH2 hub, is based on blue hydrogen,
a term used to refer to hydrogen produced from natural gas.
And so to that degree, you know, it represents a perpetuation and increased reliance on natural gas and fossil fuels.
The Biden administration says part of the new projects will be finding safe ways to capture and store CO2 emissions left over from making hydrogen this way. Min Khoi Lee is the global head of hydrogen research at Rystad Energy and says the scale of an experiment like this is unprecedented.
That is the biggest single fundings that we see governments around the world has given to hydrogen.
Lee says that's why this investment is a big deal for the U.S. and for the planet. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you know, we've regretted that in the aftermath.
Hindsight is always 2020. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on this Friday. The Dow up 39 points, a little over a tenth percent, 33,674. The blue chips. The Nasdaq subtracted 166 points. That's 1.25%, 13,407. The S&P 500 shrank 21 points, about a half percent. 43.27. For the week, the Dow added 0.8%, the NASDAQ down 0.2%, the S&P 500 increased almost half of 1%. Checking in on those big banks that Matt Levin was telling us about, JP Morgan Chase added 1.5%, Wells Fargo pocketed 0.3%, Citigroup slipped about 0.25%, Boeing and its supplier Spirit AeroSystems announced they are expanding the scope of their investigation into quality control problems with parts for the 737 MAX 8 aircraft. Boeing descended 0.3%. Spirit AeroSystem Holdings dropped 1.6%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down 4.62%. To end the week, you are listening to Marketplace. Big news, one generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Here's one for the gamers among you, and it comes with the observation that gaming, as a slice of the overall entertainment industry, is bigger than movies and music put together, and by a lot, too. The news is that Microsoft has finally closed its $69 billion deal to buy the video game maker Activision Blizzard. Regulators globally, not just here, had been leery, worried that Microsoft, maker of the Xbox, of course, would be able to profit improperly by taking over the company that produces, among other hits, Call of Duty and World of Warcraft, thus controlling the content and the platform. Well, Microsoft cleared the last hurdle today. It was offered by UK antitrust regulators by giving up some control over video games that stream from the cloud rather than running on those home consoles. As Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, the cloud is a new frontier in the gaming world.
Streaming games can be a lot cheaper than buying a $500 console, says Joost van Toynen, a business professor at NYU.
You pay your $50, you get access to a buffet, and then you can play as you want. You can stream it to your tablets, you can stream it to your PC, you can stream it to your console.
Cloud gaming sales hit about $5 billion last year, compared to about $35 billion for console games. The leading service, Microsoft's Game Pass, has about 25 million subscribers.
if you compare it to a Netflix or Disney Plus or HBO Max, like those are really just still rookie numbers.
Streaming games is a lot harder than streaming sports or movies, says Tim Hanlon, a media technology consultant and founder of Vertair Group.
You double, triple, cube the amount of intense bandwidth needed with rich virtual and visual experiences and the connectivity of voice and maybe video.
When you're binging on Netflix, content can preload as bandwidth becomes available. But when you're competing in a multiplayer game while trash-talking your opponent, the data needs to refresh immediately. Michael Pachter at Wedbush Security says hardcore gamers who want the most high-fidelity experience likely won't be switching to streaming anytime soon.
I do not think it's the end of consoles.
Instead, Pachter says streaming could bring new audiences to gaming.
You know, it's the 40-year-old guy who's got a family and he just can't even justify buying a console anymore.
$15 with the option to quit after a month might be more doable than dropping $500. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The Inflation Reduction Act that became law last year is pushing Americans to make their houses greener by making eco-friendly purchases a bit more wallet-friendly, too. Among them, tax credits for rooftop solar panels of up to 30% of the cost. But going solar can come with its own challenges and unexpected costs down the road. Alana Samuels wrote about buying a house with leased solar panels already on it in time. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So your saga of the leased panels on your roof is a long one. Give us the short-ish version of how you came to this story.
Saga is the right way to describe it. I bought a house that had leased solar panels. We tried to the best of our ability to make sure that they were working before we bought the house and moved in. Moved in, got a high electric bill, found out that they were not actually working, even though the company told us that they were. And getting them fixed was not an easy part of the saga.
So what did you do?
Well, I did something that a lot of people can't do, which is I said I was a reporter and I wanted to do a story on it. And they got back to me right away. The more common thing for a lot of people with leased solar panels, especially if the company has gone out of business that installed it like mine did, is they call and they wait and they wait and they call again and they wait. And that's what's happening to a lot of people. Fortunately for me, it only took a couple months to get it resolved, although it's not fully resolved. I did get some attention because I was a reporter.
The reason I wanted to talk to you about this is because while there are new incentives for solar and it is becoming more, you know, this is in air quotes, mainstream, back 8-10-ish years ago, because they were so expensive, these systems were often leased, and that's a whole financial arrangement in and of itself. And as you point out, it can be really problematical and expensive.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? There are still a lot of leases today. I think it's about 2/3 used to be leased, 1/3 are now leased. And the way that companies often finance these leases is they package them up, kind of like they did mortgage-backed securities, and they sell them. And so you have these leases kind of moving around the economy, and it's possible that the company that owns your leases does not have the best motivations to make sure that your panels are working to the best of their ability.
Yeah, and anytime you mention mortgage-backed securities, that just that raises all kinds of alarm bells. Also, something you said a minute ago, the company that put yours on went bankrupt, and you say in this piece a lot of these companies actually go under.
Yeah, it's kind of bananas how many companies installed solar panels at one point and are no longer around. But a lot of companies just don't make it because solar is expensive, and it's something that you really have to do right. So you see a lot of companies that tried this and it didn't work. That's, you know, companies that tried this 10 years ago and companies that tried this 1 year ago. And then you're left as a homeowner with panels from someone that is no longer around.
You sent a Freedom of Information request to the Federal Trade Commission to find out how widespread some of these problems are. What did you find?
Yeah, so the number of complaints to the FTC's database, it's kind of their fraud database that they share with a bunch of law enforcement agencies, has just skyrocketed since really 2020. There are about 5,000 complaints this year, and the year isn't even over. Last year, there were 4,000 in the whole year. So, you know, there's a lot of money out there with the Inflation Reduction Act, as you mentioned, but there's also a lot of bad actors who are really using this money to make well for themselves, but maybe not well for anyone else.
Let's get back to you and your solar panels. You said they're not quite working yet. How much longer until, and how much has it cost you to get them semi-working so far?
Well, the company doesn't seem particularly concerned because they're working pretty well. I think there's just like one or two that isn't online. And they have a lot of people who are calling them and saying, you know, my roof is leaking, my panels aren't working. You know, I consider myself lucky to have some of the panels working now and be getting some power from them.
Would you do it again?
Would I buy a house with a leased solar system? Yeah. I would try to avoid it. But, you know, it's really hard to buy a house right now. I mean, you've covered this a lot, but we were looking for a long time, and the cost of the solar panels were a tiny fraction of the cost of the house. So we didn't really think twice about it. You know, we've regretted that in the aftermath, but it's hard to make that be the thing that's going to stop you from buying a house, unfortunately.
Right. Alana Samuels, she's a senior economics correspondent at Time. Alana, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, in which beer increasingly is going non-alcoholic. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal that NA beer sales in this country, NA, non-alcoholic, right, for the year that ended in early September were up 32%. Over the past 4 years, sales up 31%. That is data from Nielsen IQ. Here, though, is the kicker. And I suppose it really just is an opportunity for NA brewers. Non-alcoholic beer sales in the United States last year were 0.9% of total beer sales here by volume. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. This one out yesterday from Cox Automotive. In the third quarter, more than 300,000 EVs were sold in this country. That's in just 3 months, 300,000 cars, the first time they have hit that total electrically. Also, Tesla is still by far the market leader, but its shares tumbled from 62% of that market to just relatively speaking here, half the EV market. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.